Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic as we continue to dig through the big old monster box of baseball cards from the 80s and early 90s. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. I appreciate you again taking some time to join us in this endeavor. And also, thank you for sharing the word about Wax Ecstatic to all of your collector friends. We've picked up quite a few listeners and quite a few followers to our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stain. So as always, thank you for doing that. That way it assures me that I'm just not talking to myself. I do that enough in my spare time, but it's always good to have an audience here. So I appreciate your help in doing that. Now, if you listen to our last podcast on the Leaf Studio set, I said, you know what? I think I'm going to see if I have any 93 Leaf cards, just the base set, because I do recall they were great cards, much like the Leaf Studio set. And also, when I was collecting hockey cards at the time, I remember collecting a lot of Leaf cards, and I figured, well, I've got to have some of those still there. Well, it turns out I don't. So apparently those ended up going out with the thousands of other cards in my great card purge of many years ago. So no podcast on 93 Leaf. I do have some comments on 93 Leaf in a little bit, but we're going to move on to the parent company's other notable brand. That would be Donruss. So we're looking at 93 Donruss this time around from Series 1, 1993. Card number 176 is our random pull. Tim, don't call me Matt Salmon. Of course, the longtime outfielder for the California / Anaheim / Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim Angels. To get all that good. Okay. Wow, yeah, he was one of the few players to be with the Angels throughout the entire time span of rather random and odd name changes, logo changes, jersey changes, you name it. And what's funny is on this card, he's pictured in the Angel uniform that they wore in 1992, and of course in 1993 they changed up their uniforms, kind of a throwback look to what they had in the late 60s and early 70s, well, really more late 60s because they changed it up again in 71. But the late 60s, once the team moved out of Dodger Stadium into Anaheim Stadium and its various name changes over the years, you had Anaheim Stadium, Edison Field, Angels Stadium is, I believe, what it's called now, unless that changed in the last week. But anyways, you know, they went to that throwback uniform in 93, and then, of course, you had the Disney-era Anaheim Angels in the mid to late 90s, and then the Arte Moreno version of the Angels, depending on which city they play in the early 2000s. So we're going to be looking at the many names, logos, and jerseys, and career of Tim Salmon on today's podcast in just a little bit. First, let's take a look at the many names and questions and comments in our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. As always, Wax and Gum Stains is open 24/7, so you're more than welcome to join us for conversation on any of our podcasts, about any of the cards we talk about, any of the players that we feature, or just something about the hobby in general. Always appreciate the conversation, and it varies from day to day and week to week. It's kind of fun looking at it, because one day you'll have conversation about a podcast, the next day somebody will talk about a card that they got. The next day, they'll talk about a player we talked about. The next day, we've got people doing active card trading there. So it's a one-stop shop, really. And again, I invite you to check it out, Wax and Gum Stains. And again, if you're a follower of us and a follower of that Twitter handle, please pass that along to your collector friends as well. A lot of comments this time around on our past podcast on 93 Leaf Studio. A lot of people agree with me. It's an absolutely beautiful set. And they especially love that Kirby Puckett was the random pull. And I don't have too many 93 Leaf Studio cards, but when I pulled that out of the stack, it's like, okay, this will be a fun one, because as much as I despised the Twins back then, I was a Blue Jays fan. Of course, the Twins knocked the Jays off in the playoffs in 91 to win the World Series. But even though I really didn't like the Twins back then, and boy, when Kirby Puckett hit that Game 6 home run, me as a Blue Jay fan at the time going, ugh. Him, of course. You know, back then I didn't care much for the team or for Puckett, but of course now, all these years later, you can look back and say, wow, what a hell of a player. And certainly the Twins teams from, you know, the mid to late 80s into, you know, pretty much 91, and then they just went off a cliff for about 10 years. It was kind of fun looking back at that. So I really enjoyed that. And so did a lot of our listeners, including Cliff. Orioles Rise is his handle. And he says, I do like that set. Also, Chris Jaskowski, who, from what I can gather from your profile, you are from Minnesota, or at least a big fan of Minnesota teams. Wow, that's a gorgeous card. I'd love to own it. I don't want to turn this podcast into a swap shop, but Chris, you're more than welcome to DM me if you want to volunteer a dollar or two for the Kirby Puckett card that I have. Alex Kent says, this is a gorgeous set. Love the logo backgrounds. And that's something that I talked about in depth in that podcast. One of the big reasons why I love that set is they utilized the team uniforms, not just logos, but elements of the uniform, be it the crest on the front. If the team had a shoulder patch, they would use that, or the logo on the front of the hat. And like I said, if you don't have many 93 Leaf Studio cards or don't remember them or you're too young to remember them, just go to Google Images, type in 93 Leaf Studio Baseball, and you'll see a whole array of cards, and you'll see what I'm talking about there. Eric Lutzen just listened to episode 60. That was the last one, and really enjoyed it. Puckett was one of my favorite players growing up in the 80s and 90s. I'm glad you enjoyed it, Eric. Now, Ben Wilson here, throwing a little shade. Nice info on the 93 set. Hashtag Kirby Puckett, not a H-O-F-er. Oh, I see what you did there, Ben. I will respectfully disagree. Obviously, when you look just at his numbers, you go, well, wait a minute, that pales in comparison to a lot of players who are in the Hall of Fame or who are on the bubble of getting into the Hall of Fame or historically have fallen just short. And there's a lot of really good players that just missed it. And, you know, they hung around on the ballot for 10 years and they didn't make it. But again, with Kirby Puckett, you know, with his situation, with his health, going into the 1996 season, all of a sudden losing vision in his right eye, there was no doubt, if you look at his entire career, talk about consistency, especially from, I would say, 84 through the 95 season. Had Kirby Puckett stayed healthy, had this vision issue not popped up on him, literally overnight, you could easily assume that he would have had another 5 or 6 years in the major leagues. And he would have probably, you know, assuming no other injuries happened along the way. And he was not an injury-prone player. In fact, when he went on the disabled list in 1996, that was the first time in his career he was on the disabled list. Now, he had injuries before, but was never on the DL. So you could assume that even in his waning years as a player, he probably, let's just guess, 130, 140 games a season, if his skills were declining a little bit. But still, even in his last year, he was hitting around 300. I mentioned in the 94 lockout, or strike-shortened season, I should say, he had a tremendous number of RBI. He could have set a major league record for that had the season not abruptly halted in the middle of August. And I think using a trajectory, you could say Kirby Puckett would have easily had 3,000 hits and 400 home runs, and who knows if the Twins would have been still pretty competitive in that time. You know, the Twins wallowed around for a few years after he left and then finally righted themselves early in the 2000s, of course, going with a different model of building a team than what they had done in the late 80s and early 90s. So it's a tough comparison, but I will make it only because this comparison was made in the death of Kirby Puckett. And that is, there are some similarities to Lou Gehrig. Of course, Gehrig's health issues were far more serious than Kirby Puckett losing vision in one eye, at least the health issue that forced his retirement. Of course, Gehrig had ALS, later known as Lou Gehrig's disease, which is a fatal disease, and it's something that is inoperable. It's something you can't just cure. But the fact that Gehrig's career was cut short and they still got him into the Hall of Fame. And yes, I know he was a Yankee, so the New York press would have easily moved him in there. But I think there are some similarities there to where, had this not happened, Puckett easily could have played at least another 5 or 6 years. I think would have followed along the same line as a lot of his contemporaries, same, you know, players who played a similar time stretch. And I'm talking about a Cal Ripken Jr., I'm talking about a Tony Gwynn, you know, talking about Wade Boggs. You know, Boggs ended up retiring, I think, after the 99 season, I want to say. But still, he would have been one of those players that easily would have gone probably through the 1990s, and I think would have been just as productive. So I'm not one for just having a charity cause get into the Hall of Fame. I think it's something that has to be earned. And I think there are a lot of players out there who I feel have earned it who still have not gotten the call. But Kirby Puckett, I think, is one of those exceptions where he was clearly on track to get a lot of the superlatives that would have meant instant Hall of Fame induction. And it's just because of a health issue that he couldn't do it. Now, some people may argue, well, he shouldn't have been a first ballot Hall of Famer. Okay, you know, I can live with that argument, but absolutely he should be in the Hall of Fame. And he was as of 2001. Now, also talking about health issues, I mentioned how when Puckett died, he was dealing with a whole lot of legal issues off the field. And then when he and his family basically escaped to Arizona to get away from this stuff, he put on massive weight and he died of a hemorrhage, cerebral hemorrhage, and hypertension was the main driving force from it. And I mentioned how, you know, he was over 300 pounds. And here's a guy who was always, especially in the later years of his life, he was kind of known as this rotund, not pudgy, not fat, but big boned. We'll go with that. He was always, a big dude in a slightly smaller frame. And I mentioned that, if you're 5'9 and 300 pounds, you're clearly not putting yourself in a good position health-wise. And I mentioned that, you know, once upon a time, I was 6 feet tall, 220 pounds, and I had to lose weight because of mild hypertension. And fortunately, over the last couple of years, I've gotten it down to 205, but my doctor will still chastise me that I've got to lose some more weight. So Dub Mentality, which is Joey W's alter ego, says, come on, dude, I'm 5'10", 220. So I say, go out there and exercise that extra weight off. Run around the block a few times. Of course, I'm saying that just kind of joking. I'm certainly not a doctor. But Joey writes back, and he says, I heard this was an effective weight loss tool, and he's got a picture of a couple of 91 Tops wrappers with the bubble gum included. Well, it could be an effective weight loss tool. But then again, you might as well just drink a bottle of apple cider vinegar, which does actually get you to lose weight, although I highly recommend you not drink an entire bottle at once. Yeah, I guess 26-year-old Topps gum might help you lose weight in unnatural ways. It also may leave something behind, so I'm not exactly sure that's the best way to cleanse the digestive tract, if you catch my drift there. Now, it's funny, you mentioned old Topps gum as being a good weight loss measure. It's funny you mentioned that because the Topps company, on their blog, if you go to Topps.com, just a few days ago, they posted a blog about the 87 Topps set, which, of course, is celebrating its 30th anniversary. It is one of the most favored sets, certainly in this generation of card collectors. It is one of mine. In fact, I've been asked before in my lifetime, what's my favorite set? And 87 Topps is pretty much right up there. And I'll also say 77 Tops, but that was the year I was born, so it's not like I remember collecting it as an infant. I waited a few years. But, you know, 87 Tops is still very, very highly regarded these days, even though there's a lot of the product out there. It's affordable, so even though it's an oversaturated product, people still love the 87 Tops set. And as you well know, 87 Tops plays an important part in the 2017 Tops set. They've got some parallel cards in the 87 Tops design. Of course, you've got the Rediscover Tops campaign that's going on where they insert those stamped vintage cards. And, some of them are really nice cards. Others are not. Just listen to my past two podcasts. You'll find out what I'm talking about there. But it's really funny. At the bottom of this blog, it says, for risk takers and thrill seekers hoping for one more taste of the 1980s, your best approach, and the word best is used loosely here, is to place the 30-year-old sugar slab beside your cheek or on your tongue and wait for it to disintegrate into a paste. which happens within about 4 seconds. Chew on the stale slab and you could get gum particles older than Jason Hayward stuck in your teeth. All right, that sounds like a fun adventure, but you could also substitute the words gum or sugary slab with masking tape or cardboard or crumbles of paper. You get the same effect and probably the same health benefits. So while the Topps blog did say, please think twice about chewing the gum, yeah, I wouldn't do it. So if you want to lose weight, do it the traditional way. Get up and move around and be a little more selective in the food that you eat and the portions that you eat. And please don't try to do it through 87 Topps gum. And finally, I'm a big fan of responses like this. Nick Pietrovoya, forgive me for butchering your name there, Nick. Nick Pietrovoya writes in, and he tags my personal Twitter account, Salmon Says, with this. Love your Wax and Gum Stains podcast. Got inspired to start collecting again with my 6-year-old son. And that is incredibly awesome. And if you know my backstory, it's a very similar one where, you know, I got away from cards for a long time and slowly started getting back in through the vice that is the Topps Heritage set. And I can't wait till that comes out within the next few weeks. But what really propelled me over the past 2-3 years to start collecting again and start mining through the monster boxes and talking about this stuff is my son. And when my son was 4 or 5, you know, he was always into sports, but around 4 or 5, I decided to introduce him to a pack of baseball cards because I figured, you know, if he's 2, well, what is he going to do with these? Probably just stick them in his mouth. So when he got to around 4 or 5, I bought a couple packs of Topps Heritage, and this would have been the 2014 set. And, you know, he opened them up and looked at them. Hey, okay, that's neat. But the next year, we bought some, the 2015 set, which was the 66 Topps style card. He really got into them. So, you know, you end up buying more and more and more. And as every spouse of a card collector these days knows, all of a sudden the credit card charges at Target started going up because we're buying more and more and more baseball cards on top of, you know, kids' clothes and, you know, eventually with my daughter coming around, more diapers and formula and all that fun stuff. But it's great to see that it's our children that are pulling a lot of us back into the hobby here. And I really think that's a big, big factor for the hobby moving forward. Because if you're my age, you know that the hobby basically cannibalized itself about 20 years ago. There were just too many cards, just in volume. There was just too much out there, too many printed. And then you had too many sets and too many subsets and subsets of subsets of subsets and parallel cards and this refractor and that refractor. And you were saying fract the refractors. There was just too much going on. And of course, you know, baseball having their own problems at the same time. You know, a lot of people turned away from the hobby in the mid to late 90s because it was just too much, just way too much. And I really think that the hobby lost a crucial generation of kids, the kids we now call millennials. I think a lot of kids that age, people who are now in their mid to late 20s, they missed out on baseball cards. And this isn't to say all of them. This is just a small group of them. They missed out on that, and they turned to other ways of entertainment, including, you know, video games on PlayStation and, you know, also Nintendo, but also computer video games, which picked up at the time. And, you know, the card collecting industry, it not only oversaturated itself, but like I said, it cannibalized itself to where now you only have 2 or 3 companies, sometimes reviving old brands. Like we've mentioned, Panini has brought back the Donruss brand, and Topps and Bowman have been around for a while. So you have some, you know, kind of resuscitated brands through that method, but there's really only a handful of companies that put out these sets now. But, there was a whole generation of kids who basically missed out on the fun that our generation and the previous generations had in collecting these. So it's really, I think, for the industry to continue to thrive, it needs to be more than just card shop owners. It needs to be more than just mega dealers and mega collectors. You know, the people that you and I buy cards from who have warehouses of boxes and boxes of cards. It needs to be more than them. I mean, that's your wholesaler, that's your supplier. But in order for the hobby to survive, you need kids buying these cards. And it's tougher and tougher to get them buying these cards and taking care of these cards, because one of the main purposes of cards when we collected was information. And again, it was the pre-internet time. This is how you knew what your players looked like, what the teams looked like, what their uniforms looked like, their stadiums looked like. This was how you got the statistics. You know, now you go on baseballreference.com, it's right there. So it's up to us to pass along the joy of opening up a pack of cards and just seeing what's inside. And I know for my son, every pack we get, he wants some card with a Tampa Bay Rays player on it. It's got to be a Rays card. And he may get the hottest rookie. He may get the coolest parallel card. He may get the insert with the shred of somebody's sock, you know, sewn into the card. But if it's not a Rays player, he doesn't care. So that's kind of the innocent joy that is missing from the hobby that needs to come back. And that's why it's really up to us, those of us who do have children, to kind of pull him right back in. So I salute you, Nick. I'm glad that he's involved in it. And Nick actually followed up with another tweet saying, so far he seems to like it. We're having fun connecting with Yankees fans across the country with our Jeter idea. And he's giving away some cards from his collection. And it's really cool to see. And Nick is also an employee with the Cleveland Indians. So I know you're getting ready to get the season going. But I appreciate you reaching out, and I'm glad that you're able to extend the hobby to your son. And hopefully others are able to do something similar to that. So a lot of action this week on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Again, pass along the Twitter handle to your collector friends. Hopefully we can entertain them with this podcast every Tuesday and Friday via Audio Boom and iTunes. Also, our complete archive is on Audio Boom. Visit audioboom.com. Type in the words Wax Ecstatic. You'll get directed to our page, and we've got all of our previous episodes there, and you can listen to them at any time. And of course, we are still looking for a sponsor. So again, I just want to throw out a quick plug here. If you're looking to be a sponsor for this program, we would love to connect with you. I follow most everybody who follows this account, so just DM me with any questions you have, any offers you have. I want to assure our listeners we're not going to flood you with a whole bunch of commercial messages. Also want to assure any potential sponsors. We're not going to oversaturate our sponsors. We're going to have one, and we're going to have somebody that has a good service that we think matches up with our listeners real well, and vice versa. Plus, it's a low price point. Win-win for everybody. All right, the namesake, kind of, to me. We spell our names differently. Tim Salmon. His last name is spelled like the fish, S-A-L-M-O-N. Mine is not, S-A-M-M-O-N. Although I've always told people who look at it funny and aren't quite sure how to pronounce it, I say, well, it sounds like the fish. So they figure it out that way. One of the rated rookies in the 93 Donruss set, card number 176 from Series 1. And when we talked about Donruss in 1992, we mentioned that they took a giant leap forward after just kind of flailing around with design, coming up with some really tacky and sometimes incredibly ugly designs in the early 90s. They finally caught up with Upper Deck and the rest of the competition in 92 by producing a high-quality card. Better card stock, better photography, better graphics, and a better selection of rookies and young stars and inserts. You know, they turned the Donruss Diamond Kings into an insert as opposed to just being part of the base set. Same thing with the MVP cards. So they started adding a few more bells and whistles to a base set that was very sharp. But as I mentioned in that podcast about 92 Donruss, while it was sharp, wasn't necessarily a whole lot better than what they were producing before. I was of the mindset, and I still am, that while the 92 Donruss set was an improvement over 91 and certainly the 1990 set, I was never a huge fan of it. I liked it, but I didn't go out and buy boxes and boxes and boxes of it. They were just, in my opinion, in 1992, better card sets than Donruss. So again, with the ever-growing hobby, where there were sets and sets and sets just being produced left and right by 1992 and certainly by 1993. If you were a teenager like I was, you had to be very careful about how you spent your money. And I just didn't spend a whole lot of 92 Donruss. So I have this rather, attitude to 92 Donruss. And I know some of our listeners loved the set. They still think it's one of their favorites from that year. And others are in my mindset of, it was good, but it wasn't that great. So 92 Donruss falls into the category of you either like it or you don't. Now, 93 Donruss, from what I gather, a lot of people like it, but again, it just didn't quite match up to the competition. And if you had to allot your money in a certain way in 1993, Donruss, as quality of a product as it was probably fifth or sixth on your depth chart. It wasn't the first one you went out and bought. It wasn't the one where if you were faced with 8 or 10 boxes of open packs in front of you from 1993, Donruss probably wasn't the first one that you grabbed. In fact, if you grabbed 5 packs, one pack from 5 separate boxes, Donruss may not have even been on that list. So, it's kind of a mixed bag here. It's a good card, but again, when you look at what else was going out in 1993, it just wasn't quite there. So 93 Donruss, just kind of like 92 Donruss, kind of falls into this crack of good, not great, but easily forgotten. It just kind of got swallowed up by everything else. So let's take a look at this random pull, card number 176, the rated rookie. Yes, Donruss actually got a rated rookie right. You know, if you've listened to this podcast long enough, you know how much I've pinged rated rookies because sometimes Donruss got them right. Often they did not. And Tim Salmon was one of those guys going into the 93 season. There was no guarantee that he was going to be a star player because he batted only 177 in the 92 season. But somebody at Donruss had some intel that this guy was going to be good enough, so they gave him the rated rookie status. But if you look at the front of the card, you see a lot of similarities to what other cards were doing. In fact, there's a lot of similarities almost to Bowman. A little bit of upper deck, but especially the Bowman side here, where there was a lot of room left for pictures and very little graphics. And that is one of the really nice improvements of the 93 Donruss set, is that they focused on photographs, on quality, on the letting the action tell the story and not necessarily the card design. So this is eerily similar, like I said, to Bowman and Upper Deck in 93, in that you have a plain white border, but still about 95% of the front of the card is devoted to a photograph. So there's no fancy designs, there's no fancy graphics. It's just, it's almost like a Polaroid photograph, if you will. It's just a picture. You have the rated rookie logo in the upper left-hand corner. Of course, that was exclusive just to these cards. Not every card had that logo up in the upper left-hand corner. The Donruss logo, kind of small in the upper right-hand logo. And then at the bottom, you had a very simple graphic. You had one bar with the player's name, his position on the far right end, and on the left in a base-shaped square. You had the team logo, and as I've said 1,000 times before, I love team logos. Put them anywhere, and especially the new/old California Angels logo of 1993. I've always loved the Angels look from the late 60s. I thought that was a really cool way of interlocking the C and the A. The one thing the Angels uniforms were missing from 93 through 96 was the halo on the top of the hat. They should have kept that. But with that said, even though the Angels were turning a new leaf here in 1993, and this would have been the first major uniform change for them in 20 years, every time I see the old Angels logo and uniform, the one that Salmon is wearing on this card from the 1992 season, I miss it. That's a great logo. And of course, the Big A, reminiscent of the old Big A scoreboard at Anaheim Stadium. And very simple color scheme. Simple design. I've always liked that Angel logo. And in fact, I may still have it buried in a box in my garage somewhere. I used to have an Angels hat, and it wasn't even a cool fitted hat. It was just like a trucker hat. And for whatever reason, I still paid $20 for it. But I bought it in like 1990 or 91. And even though I was a Blue Jay fan, I just always liked this particular Angel logo. It was always cool. So we see that logo rather prominently on the back of the card. So let's flip it over here. As Tim Salmon looks like he's stretching at a batting practice or spring training or whatever. Photographer gets him to flash a little bit of a smile here. And you've got that classic Big A logo on his hat there. And a very classic and clean look to the Donruss card back. And that is a major improvement over 92. If you recall the 92 Donruss, I like how they had a lot of stats and a lot of information, and they included a player photo amongst all that stuff. But with the player photo kind of bleeding into the stats, and the player photo, which was pretty much a headshot, right smack dab in the middle of the card, there was just a whole lot of information there. And then sometimes the picture bled into the stats, and it can make it hard to read. None of that stuff here. In fact, the 93 Donruss back, very similar to the 92 Fleer back, eerily similar, but I like it. I've always liked the backs to the 92 Fleers, and 93 Donruss was no exception. Nearly half the card is allotted to the picture. You've got his name in the upper left-hand corner, card number on a home plate-shaped stamp on the upper right-hand corner, and then beneath that, recent career stats, and of course with Tim Salmon spending most of his time in the minor leagues. You had some minor league stats, and that was a first for Donruss too, which shied away from minor league stats ever since they started up in 1981. So a nice little breakdown here. You also have his contract status and how acquired, which was something that was featured through some previous sets there. So a very clean look, a very nice look. And like I said, it takes some elements. The front of the card takes some elements from 93 Upper Deck, 93 Bowman, and that's mostly in just the idea of a frame and a photo and very few graphics. And then it quite honestly thieved the back of the card from the 92 Fleer set. Really, the only thing missing from 93 Donruss compared to 92 Fleer was the vertical stripes going down where the stats were. That was pretty much it. But overall, a nice set, very classy, very sharp, but again, it didn't really match up to the rest of the competition. And as we continue to go through the 1993 sets in our next few podcasts, you will see Upper Deck is very similar. We already did Bowman. It looks just like it. But there were some sets that were better. Leaf Studio. Also, I always liked 93 Tops. I think it's kind of more in the class of Donruss. But Topps Stadium Club was very flashy and certainly a high quality, better set than Donruss. So again, imagine yourself in the hobby shop or in your Walmart. It's June 1993. You're standing in front of the shelf full of wax packs, and you have $5, and you can only buy five packs of cards. You're probably not going Donruss first. Probably not. So it was good, but not great. It was sharp, it was clean, but not memorable. And what also hurts the 93 Donruss set is there's not really any tremendous rookie cards. And again, the inserts, while there were plenty of insert cards, it was still much of what they did in 92, where you had the Donruss Diamond Kings, the MVP cards, you had some other insert cards that had a little value added to it, but nothing that really jumped out at you. You know, it wasn't like the gold cards that Topps had. It wasn't like the members' choice cards that Stadium Club had. It just didn't have that. So Donruss was good, but not great. And unfortunately, because of the assortment of cards in the set, a 792 card set, which while that mirrors the number of Topps cards for many years, this was the largest Donruss set up until that time. It just didn't really stand out. It just didn't. It was nice, but it just didn't launch itself over some of the competition. So over the years, it's kind of gotten lost in the shuffle. Now, with that said, if you do have some extra money, it is not a bad set to go out and buy. I have seen wax boxes going anywhere from $10 a box to $20 a box. So shop carefully because you can get some good deals. I've seen some places that have two for 20. I've also seen some jumbo boxes for, $25. And the jumbo boxes contain more of the insert cards. So if you're looking for a little extra bang for your buck, that might be the way to go there. And another interesting quirk about the 93 Donruss set is that they didn't really make any attempt to showcase any of the new Florida Marlins players or Colorado Rockies players in their new uniforms. Now, we did 93 Bowman with Carl Everett, and Bowman was a set that was released a little later than the others. Bowman would come out in April or May, so you had some spring training pictures, or in the case of Carl Everett, maybe it was a rookie camp picture, so you could see him in his Marlins gear. And of course, with the Marlins and Rockies coming in 1993, you had very 1993 uniforms. I've talked about the teal of the Marlins and the purple of the Rockies, which they still use as a primary color. If you wanted to see a card that looked like 1993, you wanted one of those two teams. So all Donruss did, because Donruss was one of the first cards to come out. I remember Donruss would be released in late February of every year. They just took pictures of the players with their previous team, and they just slapped a Rockies or Marlins logo on the base shape near the player's name. So it was very awkward looking, where you got this Colorado Rockies card, but it was a guy who played for the Atlanta Braves or something like that. So that's a neat little quirk there if you want to have some oddities in the set. But again, this is a set where if you have, you know, $20-$25 just laying around, you want to see what you can get for it, you can probably assemble most of a series by getting a couple of boxes of these cards and just having a nice set that's there. It is certainly not a bad set, not a bad looking set, but it's just one of those sets that just kind of, you know, it just doesn't leap out at you. And even 24 years later, it still doesn't. All right, as for our random poll, Tim Salmon, number 176. Like I said, this is a guy whose name sounds like mine and is spelled like the fish. And yeah, I got a little ribbing for this when I was a youngster. Everybody said, "Ooh, can I get a Tim Salmon card from your uncle?" To which I often offered up a profanity. But no, we're not related, despite the similarities here. But Tim Salmon had quite the career, not Hall of Fame worthy, but once an Angel, always an Angel. And I joked earlier about how this guy lived through every rendition of the Angels' name and almost every uniform and logo that they've had, certainly in the last 25 years, as a member of the California Angels, then the Anaheim Angels, and then wrapping up his career with the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. But he started out as a draft choice of the Atlanta Braves. They drafted him in the 18th round of the 1986 amateur draft. He did not sign. He went to college as he stood out at Grand Canyon University in Phoenix. Yeah, Grand Canyon University. It sounds like one of those universities that are just online that you pay for now. That's not the case. No, he succeeded at Grand Canyon University. And just a few years later, in 1989, the Angels came calling at draft time. They pick him up in the third round of the draft, and he did sign. And he would remain an Angel for the rest of his life, even though he was granted free agency following the 2005 season. He re-signed with the Angels in 2006. But as I mentioned, you know, once he made his debut in 1992, had a cup of coffee, 23 games, 92 plate appearances, batted only .177, two home runs, six RBI. So this is another one of those players who really didn't stand out in his rookie season, but would become a star. He was able to show the prospect and the promise in future seasons. Well, it didn't take Salmon long to do that. In fact, in 1993, as a regular outfielder for the California Angels, in fact, he spent most of his season in 93 in right field. In fact, most of his career in right field as well, although he did later on in his life play the role of the designated hitter. Well, in 1993, 142 games played. He batted .283, 31 home runs, 95 RBI. He was the American League Rookie of the Year for 1993. And he would have a career where his batting average was typically in the 290s. I would say on average, you know, anywhere from 280 to upwards of 330. He batted .330 in the 1995 season. And his home run production very consistent, around 30 a season. And he would also knock in quite a few runs as well. He had RBI totals as high as 129 in 1997. On average, I'd say right around 100. And this was a pretty dependable guy. Now, because he was a power hitter, he also struck out quite a bit, never led the American League in strikeouts. But it did average, as I'm scanning through his stats here, around 130 strikeouts a season. So this was a guy who was cut from the same cloth in terms of batting performance as Dave Kingman, Gorman Thomas, you know, that's really reaching back. But also you can look at guys like Jose Canseco, Mark McGwire, guys that would either hit the ball 450 feet or provide a 45-mile-an-hour breeze with the swing of the bat. But if there's one thing that Tim Salmon was, it was very consistent. This guy was not injury prone. He did miss much of the 1999 season, but had a pretty solid career right up until 2004, where he did suffer some major injuries that almost ended his career early. In fact, he missed the entire 2005 season as he was recovering from rotator cuff surgery. That's a surgery, of course, more in line with pitchers, but for some outfielders, that's something that does creep up on you. But other than the 99 season, where he only appeared in 98 games, and then his final three seasons, 04, 05, and 06, this was a guy who was in the lineup almost 90% of the time, and he was 100% consistent. Career batting average of .282, an on-base percentage of only .385, and that accounts for a lot of those strikeouts. But a guy who would average 98 RBI a season, 29 home runs, and he finished his career with 299 career home runs and only 1,674 hits. But again, if he wasn't mashing the ball out of the yard, chances are he was striking out. Your prototypical power hitter here, not exactly a contact hitter, but a power hitter. And amazingly, and I don't know if this is because he was a home run hitter slash strikeout artist or just because he was playing for the Angels. And of course, even though the Angels are in the shadows of the number two market in terms of television and radio, you're always in the shadows of the Los Angeles Dodgers. You're always in the shadows of other great outfielders. And Tim Salmon was never an all-star. And that is kind of shocking to me, actually. A guy who averaged 282 at the plate, 29 home runs, 98 RBI a season, and was a rookie of the year in 1993, was never an all-star. And he was also in the MVP running for three seasons, in 95, 97, and 98. Now, distant running, but he still finished seventh in two of those three seasons. So this was a guy who maybe didn't wow you, but was very respectable and a very consistent hitter. He would retire in October of 2006. Also, his number 15, while it has not been officially retired, it has not been given out to any Angels players since. And that's normally a sign. Now, it's not just in baseball. That's in any sport. When a well-loved player leaves his team or retires, as the case may be, if the number isn't assigned again, then it's probably being saved for retirement. And in retirement, Tim Salmon has moved on into broadcasting, as he has done pre- and post-game color analysis for Fox Sports West with the Angels broadcast. So a nice move to him. He is still very much alive and well in Southern California and very much active in the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim and their team. So all these years later, once an Angel, always an Angel, still an Angel, Tim Salmon, no relation. Card number 176 from the 93 Donruss set. Now, real quickly, before we wrap up, I wanted to bring up 93 Leaf. Just want to throw in a quick plug for that set. Even though I don't have any 93 Leaf cards, I do recommend that if you have a few extra bucks available, try to catch a box or two of these, because much like the Leaf Studio sets that were outstanding, 93 Leaf really was, in fact, very similar to the Fleer Ultra sets at the same time. You would have a full color photograph taking up almost the entire card. The difference was in the lower right hand corner, you had the player's name and position and team. But then when you flip it over, this was my favorite part of the 93 Leaf cards. You not only had the usual stats, but you had the player action photo superimposed over a picture of some city landmark in the city he played in. So, you know, if you had, you know, the New York Mets, you would have a player on the Mets with the Manhattan skyline behind him, or the Brooklyn Bridge. You know, same thing if it was a San Francisco Giants player, you'd have the Golden Gate Bridge in the background. So that was a really neat way of taking the player and the team he played for and putting it in a geographical setting. So I always liked that about 93 Leaf, and I remember why I bought so many 93-94 Leaf hockey cards. That was the second season the Tampa Bay Lightning was in the NHL. So it was neat seeing your favorite players from your favorite team with, you know, shots of the Tampa skyline in the background, or I think they had like the Sunshine Skyway Bridge, you know, some really cool pictures where you can say, hey, that's where I live. It was a kind of a neat thing to look back on. So a quick plug on 93 Leaf, because I don't have any cards for it. I didn't want to totally stiff them, but much like Leaf Studio, a great set to have. If you can track it down, great. If you can get good value on a couple boxes, buy them. Again, I caution you, that's not a set that's going to rise in any value or appreciation anytime soon. After all, it was made in 1993 when so many other sets were. But it's really a great set to have, and I think it complements the 93 Studio set rather nicely. Now, as for 93 Donruss, if you want to talk about that or the career of Tim Salmon or anything else about our podcast or the hobby in general, you can do so at Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed, which is open 24/7. And who knows, maybe your comments will be included in an upcoming podcast. Now, we mentioned Fleer Ultra, and that is a set that really jumped out to prominence in 1992. We're going to do a random pull from the small assortment of 93 Fleer Ultra cards I still have, and we will discuss that on Friday. So make sure you tune in on Audio Boom or iTunes for our discussion of 93 Fleer Ultra, another great set from Fleer Ultra, even though the Fleer base set was pretty much laid to waste in 1993. The Ultra set was top-notch. Once again, I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you Friday when we talk more about this great hobby of ours on the Wax Ecstatic podcast.